Blog Talk Radio.
VOP Freedom Radio's Alternatives for a Healthier Lifestyle with your host, Hank McGrath, and co-host, Professor Eric Carlson, bringing the best to you from the Hudson Valley and Southern Adirondacks of New York. Now, Eric Carlson is the founder and director of BrainWise Solutions, LLC, an innovative therapeutic training and consultation practice that offers individual and group therapy as well as consultation and training. He has completed psychedelic integration training with the Fluence Group and is scheduled to complete his MDMA trauma facilitator training with the MAPS Institute in the spring. Your host, which is me, D.H. McGrath, is a self-help author, NLP practitioner, certified life coach, and rights advocate and entrepreneur. Now, the first half of the show will be with special guest Steve Bean, a member of the Therapeutic Men's Council in the Hudson Valley. And the second half of the show is where Professor Carlson will discuss the plant therapy of ayahuasca, a plant-based psychedelic. We will also share an interview by Joe Grogan with comedian actor Ron White on his ayahuasca experience. And we'll also have Dave Chappelle on, his unsupervised experience with using mushrooms when the professor and I taught the need to be supervised receive instruction and have people looking over you when this kind of therapy is used. So without further ado, I would like to say hello to Professor Carlson. How you doing today, brother?
I'm doing great. Great to have you back and to do the show together.
Yeah, it's rather cool. And let's bring Steve on. Steve?
Yeah, good afternoon to both of you.
Thank you. We just remember our phones are our microphones, and any thing that's going on behind us, we eliminate it so it's very quiet, and we don't play the show or there'll be feedback coming through our microphone. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Steve with the Therapeutic Men's Council in the Hudson Valley of New York. Steve, tell us a little bit about this Therapeutic Men's Council.
I'd love to, Hank. It's really near and dear to my heart, something that is a kind of a coming back around to for me. I was part of men's groups in the late 80s and early 90s, focused first around preventing violence against women, but they grew into focus on what men need, you know, not just to solve the problem of violence against women, but to prevent it and to have men be whole, healthy people. So I was working with Eric, Professor Carlson, one-on-one as an individual therapeutic arrangement, and he invited me to this group he was starting. We call it our Council of Men, and it was really something that I needed. It was really something I was hungry for. I'm a white male in my mid-50s. I'm a bisexual in a long-term relationship with a woman, and I've had a long career in nonprofit, executive nonprofit, but COVID and an illness in my family and a personal betrayal had me in a state of post-traumatic stress disorder that I didn't even realize. I had, I think, what would have been called a nervous breakdown back in the day that we now call PTSD. And when Eric told me about the group and asked me to join, I knew immediately it was exactly the kind of thing I needed. I don't know if I'd say it saved my life, but it certainly saved my selfhood. And it's really characterized by what I would call sort of the ABCs of a council of men. So authenticity, the men come to the group with no judgment of each other. They bring their wholeness, their whole people. They're open, and they give authenticity to get it. And the group is really about B, bearing witness, listening to each other, being fully present, and then C, community. I think it's become kind of a mutual support network. I'm not sure that was really in the original design, but I think that's what we've turned it into in part as a group. It's a place where men can go and get support that they need outside of the other parts of their life.
Very, very interesting. And it is difficult to put together groups. I have a lot of experience with that. I have a New York region adult survivors of child abuse. And we work with NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And in their stats, that's NAASCA.org, in their stats, they found that over 90% of adults that finally come forward with child abuse, sexual abuse, stuff like this, do so at the latter period of their life, meaning these stories were never heard. They were never helped by any aspect of the system, nor any agency. And of course, there wasn't genuine groups, you know, where men could share and witness and testify to circumstances as there is today. That's pretty sad odds, wouldn't you say, Steve?
Yeah, I would, Hank. It is sad odds, and it certainly speaks to my own experience. You know, like I said, I've been having PTSD, but at the time, like when I was in the depths of it, I couldn't recognize it. I wouldn't have called it that. I wouldn't have even necessarily said that's what was going on. So I relate to being in that state of trauma and not being able to see it for what it is and needing time and help to get perspective on it. And, you know, I hope those folks get that the way I feel like I've gotten it in this group and tried to provide for other men. We're on our second kind of chapter in this group, and we've brought in two new men who weren't in the original group. And, I really want to see those men get the same authenticity, bearing witness, and community out of the council that I have.
Beautiful. Now, Professor Carlson, it's very important that the right person, I would think, facilitates these groups, is there to guide or answer, you know, very complex questions, as in your case, you facilitate this group. Well, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think it's certainly important for people to have, training and background, depending upon what the type of group is. as far as it being a therapeutic group. I think it's important for people to have, you know, a counseling or social work background. It certainly lays the foundation. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the, quote, expert is really the source of the healing in the group. I think the facilitator's role is really to create and set the tone for the environment being safe, kind of a sacred environment. I think Steve really put it well with the ABCs, and that once that secure and safe and predictable environment is established, you know, the resources within all these men, you know, get unleashed, and they, and really the power is in the group process and in the kind of the connection and the cohesiveness. The whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts. And one of the things I want to just comment quickly on what you said about the child abuse, I think regardless of what the issue that we're dealing with, whether it's abuse from the past, you know, concerns about, you know, our physical appearance or our sexuality or whether we're doing well in school, the first thing we have to do is give all people permission to be able to reach out for this help and also to identify some of the signs. You know, we've gone a long way in destigmatizing getting help, but I don't think we're necessarily all the way there. I think women are probably a little bit ahead in this game because they've been given more permission and maybe are more able to share their feelings. But I think before people come forward, this has to be normalized, just like going to a checkup with your doctor. Mental health shouldn't have to come to where someone is near severe depression or hospitalization before it's okay to get help. You know, we get preventative medical help, and the preventative part needs to include the mental health aspect, because that certainly affects all other aspects of our health.
I totally agree. Some of this is pioneering. The stuff I've witnessed you be involved in for a number of years is on the edge of pioneering. And it's true, you're part of changing times, both you and Steve and the men in the group. It's very important how sometimes when systems change, they always must, it seems to be innate human nature, find a victim to blame or someone to blame. And someone who's a victim that needs healing. And what we've witnessed, or I've witnessed throughout the years, is that does turn seemingly more toward women, where women could even be abusers, but it's because they're a victim. But men, it has been in the shadows. It's shameful. It's all kinds of feelings you go through. You know, I'm working on book two of Slave in Modern America, and the hardest part, guys, is I'm a runaway. This is how book one ends. I get on a bus. I'm 12 years old. I lied to the bus people and everything, and I end up in the city of Pittsburgh at night, all right, with nothing but pimps, prostitutes, stuff like that. And I have to go back into my memory that has to do with hustling. That has to do with a little, you know, Oliver Twist type lifestyle as well. And some of it becomes painful, and some of it requires me to talk to someone like you, Eric, you know, to be in a group and stuff like that. So it's very important when we start. You helped us with book one to delve into the past and shine the light on it, discuss it, without shame, without anxiety. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Hank, if I can just jump in here, I feel like what you're saying, you know, really speaks to that authenticity, that A in the ABCs. I think, you know, Eric, Professor Carlson, deserves a lot more credit than he's giving himself for not only being a trusted facilitator in creating the space he described, but also selecting, I think, carefully the group of men for this first group who could be authentic. And for me, getting at those things you're talking about, what Eric often calls like the shadow, it's you have to be able to leave what I call your machismo baggage at the door. So you have to come into a group like ours and be able to get away from all those things that have traditionally defined toxic masculinity: competition, one-upping the other men in the group, you know, fronting, bravado, always acting like you're on top of the world, even when you're not, a certain hardness, you know, armor, I call it, and being focused on your accomplishments. And, you know, those things have to be left at the door, and there has to be a safe space to do that. And I think, you know, the facilitator really sets that tone. And then it requires what you just described a minute ago, which is taking risk to be vulnerable. And in our group, I'll call him Michael. Our Michael was one of the first people who took up space to tell his story and be vulnerable and really, you know, Eric created the safety, Michael took the risk, and then that set that as a norm for the group going forward.
Well, the mathematics of human nature is amazing. And you're absolutely right, Steve. Professor Carlson I hope that he achieves all his goals because he has so much going on there. And he's really a golden individual, a friend of mine for a number of years. We've worked on all kinds of crisscross projects, and all of them have been successful. And I'm thankful to be his friend as well. With that, I'd like to bounce first to Eric to say something regarding your hopes for the group. And after Eric's finished, Steve, could you send a message out to the brothers that are in the group and anyone who you know is thinking about joining the group? Thank you. Eric?
Well, I think one of the things, we began the group in January of 2022. And, you know, during that time, it was just, you know, we were just kind of beginning to see some openings for people to kind of get out in the world, but still COVID was really rampant. And, you know, we started the group in a Zoom format, and so that, you know, we didn't have the risk of people coming together in person. And fortunately, with, you know, what has happened is it's become a little bit safer and it's evolved. We've been able to do in-person meetings. We actually have done those where we've done a day long and sometimes even longer than that. And it has shown, like, the importance of that initial setting. And it was interesting, and I'm interested to hear what Steve has to say about this. The initial Zoom meetings, I think, created kind of a little bit of comfort and safety for people because they could be sitting on their own couch, and it allowed the groundwork of connection and trust and predictability be established. And then we finally got together in person. To me, what was surprising, it's like, oh my God, some of these guys I hadn't even met before in person, and it felt as though I always had known them. So that was kind of an interesting thing, but certainly it just shows the impact of us being isolated from one another and the real need to connect in person, give each other a hug, look each other in the eye, and just feel that human connection. And the other quick thing I just wanted to say, which is sort of just echoing what Steve said, you know, as boys and as men, we're so encouraged to focus in on our strengths and our successes and to tell our success story. You know, oh, this is what I did and this is what I achieved, and our resume is oftentimes a listing of successes. But what about, and I don't even want to necessarily use the word failure because I'm of the mind that everything is an opportunity to learn, even if we obviously make mistakes and the mistakes are painful. But what about the freedom and the space to tell that non-success story and to tell it with people not judging but saying, boy, do I relate to that. Boy, do I identify with that. So I'm kind of interested in what both of you have to say about, you know, about those things.
Steve?
Well, it's, I, you know, as usual, Eric's reading my mind. You know, I want to go back briefly, Hank, to how I took what something you said. And I want to put this out there with the caveat that I think we live in an amazing time of gender creativity where people can be their true selves without being stuck in a binary gender configuration. And there are other cultures that have had more than two genders. Now, that said, I feel like a lot of people in the media and other places right now are talking about a crisis of masculinity in our culture, in our era. You know, particularly you hear stories these days about, you know, men, you know, not going to college in droves. And I don't really see it as a crisis. I see it as part of like a centuries long striving to discover the best of what it means to be a man. And in terms of that binary gender, what it means to be, you know, what the best of what it means to be a man is different from women. And, you know, you talked earlier about the attention paid to women's challenges, and those are real. But as you said, that combined with sort of that machismo baggage that I, you know, as I call it, has meant that men haven't felt like they could talk about that. And so, you know, you asked me what I hope for, or the message I would want to send out. You know, we very intentionally called our group, when we decided we needed a name, a council of men. And that's not meant to be any kind of cultural reference to anything other than a place where men share leadership, and that leadership is about holding the space for them to tell their real story. And underlying that is the idea that you have intrinsic value, regardless of, you know, and Eric was searching for a word, your failures, or as I like to call them, your struggles. And in fact, going through those struggles increases your intrinsic value. That lived experience is valuable to yourself, and it's also valuable to other men. And the message I would want to put out there is just to men who are seeking that space to be held, to be a whole person, to tell their story, and to evolve out of that and help other men evolve and do, you know, be their best, you know, reach out to us, reach out to any man in your life who you think can bring those ABCs, especially starting with that authenticity, to a conversation and go from there.
Very powerful, indeed. And I'm working on a campaign to ratify the Declaration of the Child's Rights in the United States. It's the only country that hasn't ratified it, even though we wrote most of it. And the reason being is to advance the quality of humanity. And I noticed that is what you guys have the finger on the pulse of, to advance manliness, the nature of it, as a way of advancing the quality of humanity. We shouldn't have a problem with all the advancements and understandings and tolerance and opening up the minds. It's just actually sharing the truth is what's important. And humanity needs to evolve and advance itself. Do you agree, Steve?
I couldn't agree more. It's so funny. As we're doing this podcast, I literally have a colleague who took a trip. You know, obviously I don't want to identify him because I haven't got his permission, but he's the classic, you know, overworked male, like workaholic. And he took a trip and he came back and he quit his job. And, you know, just saying he had an epiphany on that trip and needed a life change. And I think, you know, I think I can speak for Eric, Professor Carlson, when I say, you know, we would love it if men had a space like you're describing, like we're trying to build in the group, where they don't have to, you know, blow their lives up to get that change that they need to be whole people.
So powerful. Steve, it's an honor. Steve Bean, it's a very, very much, hey, kids must have made fun of you when you were little, right, Steve Bean? Just
Hank, it's gone through iterations, right? When I was really little, it was, are you related to Judge Roy Bean? Then it was L.L. Bean.
Yeah, right.
Then it was Mr. Bean. And I'm sure it'll be something else before too long.
Well, I'm old
Mr.
enough
Bean
to remember
was cool.
Orson Bean, so.
Yeah. Yeah, right? But it's an
Can
honor
I just say
having
one
you
more?
On the show. And the Yes,
Can I just
absolutely.
Put in one more quick thing? One of the topics we've started to talk a little bit about, Steve identified himself as being in his 50s. I'm in my early 60s. And, you know, we've started to have a conversation about our responsibilities as, you know, for lack of a better word, elders in the council, you know, and some of that comes from, you know, sort of the Native American culture. But the idea being, as we get older, we shouldn't just be retiring and playing shuffleboard, not that that's necessarily what everybody's doing, but what responsibilities do we have to the next generation? And I think that's a topic.
Beautiful.
That the first thing we have to do is just acknowledge that it's okay to be, you know, in this process of aging, that maybe our bodies aren't what they were like in our 20s, but we have, you know, a lot of wisdom, a lot of experiences, positives, negatives, everything in between. But our sharing of those stories and the wisdom and the lessons we have is just essential, you know, for, I guess, lack of a better term, the younger generation. And it's always great when one of our new members is a younger person relative to our other guys. But I think that that's something that certainly, and you know from a lot of your work, when you look at really troubled people that may end up joining gangs, one of the common denominators is they don't know an older person that they and would want to emulate. And that's really, really sad, you know. And emulating somebody is not about like, oh, you're rich and you made all this money. It's really like, you know, I respect the way that person has conducted themselves in their life. And, you know, we have to be in contact with younger people for them to see that these experiences matter and the lived experience matters.
Absolutely. And I was writing notes as you were talking, and that's going to be a special show, maybe three shows from now. How do you like that, Professor Carlson? So we're going to bring that up, the wisdom from elders and what responsibility do they have in the growth and advancement of humanity. That's going to be rather cool. Steve, again, it's an honor having you on, and I hope to have you on soon in the future again. And we're going to move on to part two. But, Steve, you want to do a shout-out?
Shout-out? Well, I just want to shout-out to the group, and I don't think we talked to them ahead of time, so I won't use anyone's names. But, you know, I told these guys there's five or six – well, now six or seven of us. And I told these guys at the last group meeting, we were kind of talking about what the group means to us and what we want out of it. And, you know, I confess that, you know, my PTSD had really resulted in almost a complete – sort of breakdown of my faith kind of in humanity, and that while they hadn't signed up for it and that they, didn't know it, that I was kind of relying on them to restore that faith in humanity. That's a pretty tall order, and none of them, you know, volunteered for it. But I have to say, I think they've done a pretty good job not even knowing that that's not explicitly knowing that that's what I was looking for them to do. I think they've done an amazing job. They're an amazing group of men. You know, as Eric said, they've had their failures, they've had their struggles, as we all have, and that makes them more incredible people to me, not less. And I just want to thank them for really saving my selfhood.
Great. And with that, I wish you well, and we're going to have you on, and the group is always on alternatives for a healthier lifestyle. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Hank.
All right. And with that, we're going to start part two, and we're going to start it with the blue pill.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, driving you mad. Do you want to know what it is? You can feel it. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, and I show you how deep it all goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. All I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Welcome back to part two of BOP, Freedom Radio's Alternatives for a Healthier Lifestyle, with Professor Eric Carlson on therapeutic plant medicine, namely ayahuasca. And it's not the blue pill. We're back, Eric. I'd like to ask you if you could break down a little bit of your pioneering, your studying of the therapeutic plant medicine. I'll give you the floor.
Sure. I mean, there's a couple of different ones I would just like to touch on in addition to the ayahuasca. There's, you know, as we know, it's in the 1960s, there was a lot of use of LSD, and, you know, some of that probably led to making a lot of these substances illegal. Fortunately, there was a lot of individuals, but the main person was a guy named Rick Doblin, who formed the MAPS Institute, which stands for the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And he started to pioneer research and eventually got the FDA to approve the study of MDMA to treat trauma. A lot of people know MDMA with the street name ecstasy, but he, you know, promoted that, and now we have about 15 years of study in its treatment of trauma. Another plant medicine is psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in what people refer to as magic mushrooms, and there has been studies at NYU and John Hopkins, as well as the Imperial College of London, and they've studied the use of psilocybin in controlled settings to treat depression, alcoholism, trauma, for smoking cessation. And the original pioneering study was actually done with people who were diagnosed with terminal cancer and were experiencing tremendous anxiety about, you know, their possibility of death and how this would impact their families. And, you know, I know we have limited time here, but when those medicines have been used in a protected setting with trained individuals guiding people, the results have really been remarkable. And I think 2023 is going to be a very significant year because we might start to see some of these medicines be approved. Ayahuasca is not a legal substance right now, but it has a long tradition of use by shaman in Peru, as well as other South American countries. And all of these substances, whether it's MDMA or psilocybin or ayahuasca, have one unique thing in common. If you look at them chemically, and we talk, and I talk about this in some of the education I do, they closely resemble the serotonin molecule. And serotonin is a neurotransmitter that is probably the most important one in our brain that controls, you know, our perception, our mood, all kinds of different things. And so what these substances seem to have in common and why they probably can be effective in treating addictions and depression and even obsessive compulsive disorder or just free-floating anxiety is they seem to do two really important things. One, they kind of turn down the activity of a structure in the brain called the amygdala. And think of the amygdala as part of the sentry at the door, like it's like the guard that's looking out for danger. And we need that part of our brain if something is life-threatening, but when that guard overreacts to everything and shoots first and thinks last, you know, then our brain is overstressed. We can't be on 24/7, like high-level vigilance. It's actually damaging to the brain, and it caused people to overreact. People with post-traumatic stress disorder overreact to stimuli that reminds them of their trauma, And sometimes it makes it so they're so reactive they don't even want to leave the house. The other part that of the brain that these things affect is what's called the default mode system. And one way to look at that is it's kind of like the ego. And I don't mean that in a bad thing, but it's like that central command system that gets us to think about and reflect on the past and the present and the future to make informed choices. But when it goes haywire, it can be the source of addictive cravings and also depressing and ruminating thoughts, obsessional thoughts that basically disable people from being able to move through the world. They're too frightened to move through the world. So these medicines seem to decrease the activity of both these regions of the brain. And when they do that, they create interconnections and allowing brain other parts of the brain to talk to one another. And usually that results, you know, that's sort of the brain chemistry, but results in people having tremendous insights. Some people even remark that they have spiritual or almost kind of religious type experiences, and that these things are so profound that they all of a sudden they're like, they don't see any purpose in drinking anymore. They don't see a purpose in, you know, self-medicating with drugs, or they don't see a purpose in these other things because their addictive cravings and depression have been lessened, and it allows them to begin to maybe focus in on more meaningful pursuits in their life. So that's kind of a quick brain lesson about how these things work. But the other thing I just want to say is that no one should use any of these substances indiscriminately. The reason we refer to these as plant medicines is because they're not recreational drugs. They're things that we should have deep respect and reverence for, and they should only really be used in safe settings, in legal settings, or in settings where you have a lot of support and people have knowledge. And I'm not advocating for the use of these things because there are some people that probably should not engage in these things that have maybe a history in their family of schizophrenia. But I've also seen in the research and in people that I've known tremendous breakthroughs. People have been in therapy 20 years. They're still depressed, and then they have, you know, a weekend with psilocybin or ayahuasca, and they break through. And I know you're going to share a clip of the comedian Ron White, whose story is pretty compelling.
Right. To simplify it, to just simplify it a little, while you were talking, I saw a tree, and I saw the circles in the tree. You know, there's many different circles, which is the age of the tree. And we look at ourselves as an essence with all them circles. In normal or regular therapy, sometimes you cannot reach the inner circles. And the use of plant-based psychedelic medicine actually not only helps the individual release some of them truths. I mean, some things you never even knew were holding you back, but also provides more assistance to the therapeutic approach. Is that correct?
Yes, I think, you know, again, within the safe setting, it can remove some of the barriers that people have that, you know, some of that is certainly societal. We must be in control all the time, that our rational brain will solve every problem. And, you know, those kind of misconceptions are sometimes what interferes with therapy. And, you know, the wisdom, in some ways, when people experience plant medicine in a positive way, they feel, you know, use the analogy of the tree, they feel so much more of an appreciation for the natural world. They see the natural world as being, having its own wisdom. Sometimes we call that the Gaia wisdom. And oftentimes one of the changes that people experience after plant medicine is much more of an openness to the ideas of others, but an openness to the world and a deeper respect for our need to protect the natural environment and to also embrace the wisdom of the natural environment, which is sometimes, I think, you know, human beings like focus on, well, you know, how can I use that tree and cut it up and, you know, make a floor for myself rather than I need to embrace the need to save the rainforest, those kinds of things.
Exactly. And with that, we're going to go right into the professor had mentioned the interview. We have one from Joe Rogan of John White's or Ron White's, excuse me, ayahuasca experience. We're going to go into that right now. And he lays it out straightforward.
The Joe Rogan experience.
Well, do you want me to tell you about the ayahuasca experience?
Oh, yeah, sure. You remember? How much do you remember?
Well, you know, I remember how I found out about it, which is weird because it was a friend of mine's wife. But I'd heard that ayahuasca word before, and so I knew a very, very little bit about it. So then I started kind of researching it. What is it? Where does it come from? It's a strong hallucinogen, you know, which I've always had a tendency to like anyway. So I thought it sounded like it was right up my alley. But for a long time, you had to get on a canoe, you know, yeah, and go down and find a corrugated tin shack and sleep on a dead floor. And so it wasn't very appealing to a lot of people. So the guy that opened the place, he had money, and he said he bought part of a J.W. Marriott beach resort. Well, he bought their overflow area, which was not on the beach, but in the jungle with a big fence. Fucking howler monkeys, the most useless animal in the world. They scream at the top of their lungs. Other monkeys must just hate them. You know, can you tone it down a little bit? Howl. So I thought, well, I'll sign up for that, and I'll use that to get off liquor, because a lot of people do come away from there with a different perspective, right, which I did. And but then I was honest with them about how much I drank, and they go, oh, no, you can't come here. We don't want you coming here and getting into DTs. We're not a detox facility, and we're not set up for it. So you have to have 14 days of sobriety before you come here. And I'm like, fuck, right? I don't know if I could do that or not, because I was drinking so much. Wow. And then I knew about this guy that was a hypnotist in Marina Del Rey, I think, is kind of where his, that's not it. It's whatever, one of the coastal towns down there. And my assistant, Anthony, had worked for a guy that had a lot of problems and went to this guy and quit all of them. And so I'm like, well, I could go over there and see how that works. So I went over there, and his office was in his garage. He was the least impressive human being I've ever met, and they had a brown wig that was on crooked, and I don't know if that was part of it, that you get focused on, dude, what's up with your wig? And that maybe got you off beat a little bit. And then he had a tall glass of water with no ice in it, and he took these little tiny sips out of it. Now, I don't know if that was part of the setup or not, but the garage thing was like a velour recliner that had to have been 30 years old, and it wasn't well kept or anything. And so I sat in there, and then he just talked about, you know, kind of what was going on with my body and all this liquor that I was pouring into it, and kind of like how your heart and your lungs and your kidney like to work together to keep you living. And I've had an all-out assault on all three of them for 50 years and you know, whatever. And so he got through with the first session, and he would put me under, and I would go under, that's for sure, and because he'd have to snap me out of it. And I was just sitting there conscious of everything he was saying, but in a whatever hypnotic state, for sure. So he was good at that. And obviously, it was kind of weird because he said, imagine you're on the 22nd floor of a building and you're getting on the elevator. And it's kind of weird because I live on the 22nd floor of a building. He didn't know that, but odd. And so I finished the first session. He says, okay, don't quit drinking. I'm like, great. I like this program. So I came back, and I thought maybe it was four sessions over a period of a month. But after the second one, I quit drinking, and I was just waiting for the shoe to fall, you know. I was waiting to start getting sick off of not drinking, and it didn't happen, and it really didn't bother me not to drink. And it was set up for, as soon as I was finished with that, I'd go straight to South whatever that pill I took, Costa Rica, and I checked into this place, and it was really, really nice. You can go, you can share a room with somebody, which they recommend that experience with somebody you don't know, but I didn't want to do that. So you can also get your own room, and it's not overly expensive compared to rehab in Malibu, you know, which I repriced at $100,000 for 30 days.
What?
$100,000.
Really?
$3,000 a night, and they recommended a minimum of 30 days, and that was on the street I lived on in Beverly Hills, up at the top of it. And so this is like, you could do this for like, if you shared a room with somebody for like $1,800 for a week. And mine was like $5,000, but I had a nice room, and it was, you know, a really nice place. They cooked all your food, and it was healthy, but it was really good. You know, it was no soda pop, no alcohol, no, you know, a lot of shit I wouldn't advertise if I was trying to get people to go down there. And but, you know, pineapple juice and coconut water, fucking great. And so you get down there, and you had a group of about 50 people, I think, was in our group that were, and everybody has their own room, but then there's this one space where everybody gets together for this experience of ayahuasca. So there's 50 mattresses on the floor that have, you know, really nice sheets and pillows and blankets, and they're on the floor, and it's very ceremonial in that, you know, there's a guy, a shaman, that looks like a shaman, feathers and shit, and you stand in line with your little cup, and he gives you a cup of this mud, awful taste and stuff. And I did mine, and I just talked to him like he's a regular person. And I said, so what do you do? And he says, well, outside there was a bunch of hammocks. It was beautiful space, really couldn't have been any better. And hammocks all around. He says, go out there and sit in a hammock, and whenever you need to, when it's time, you just come back in. I said, how do I know when it's time? He goes, oh, you'll know. I was like, okay, all right. So I took my ayahuasca and I went out there. And I'm like, oh, it's kind of like mushrooms a little bit. I felt myself coming onto it. And then I opened my mouth, and the entire forest poured into it. And I'm like, that's probably the signal right there that it's time to go in. I think I get it. So I went in, and I laid down on my bunk. Now, some people throw up on it, so you have a puke bucket too. But some people get the shits. I got the shits. Vomiting's way better because you can vomit from your bed. But if you got the shits, you got to get up and find someplace. There's bathrooms, a lot of them. So, but I never thought I'd see people throwing up in a bucket and go, lucky. I wish I was throwing up, but I got the shits. And so I laid down and I tripped so hard, and it was really dark. And they said lean towards the dark side. So if there's a rainbow and a unicorn, and then there's a guy you don't understand in your yard, go towards the dark guy in the yard. Don't hop on the unicorn and jump over the rainbow. Go the other way. And don't fight it. Just let it happen. But I think I just struggled with it the first night. And I was getting really distorted images of people's faces when they got close to me. And I was tripping so hard that I was like, my head was itching, and I just couldn't figure it out, you know, how to make my head stop itching. And I thought about scratching it, but I wasn't exactly sure how to use my hands anymore. And somebody walked by, and I asked them to scratch my head. And they're like, yeah, sure. It's like this. Yeah. Oh, that's it. That's it. That's good. And I really thought towards the end of that I wouldn't do it again. Because I just didn't see the benefit of it. You know, it scared me. It didn't scare me, but it wasn't pleasant at all. You know, like, it wasn't like mushrooms, and it wasn't like acid. To me, it wasn't. And you could almost see somebody's skull when they were too close to you, and it was, I was just wanting it to be over. And the beautiful thing about ayahuasca is it is over. I mean, it only goes for like 2 hours, and when it's done, it's done. And so they time it so you can do more, you can do all you want, but not past a certain point. And then it's at one point they turn on the lights and go, good morning, and it's over. You know, you can't just go home, go back to your room and go to sleep real fast, but it's over. All those things are gone. It gets out of your system completely so fast. And then there's, you know, there's music, there's a, you know, live band, or, you know, people in congos and guitars and shit. So it's funky. And some people were, even while I was in my wildest point of this trip, they were up just dancing around the room. I'm like, Jesus Christ, how are you doing this? I don't understand. And so I thought, I think that's about enough, right? And then by the next day, once I got out of it, and then people were kind of sit around and share their experiences and whatever. And I was into the whole thing, and I was really trying to surrender myself to the experience. You know, I was trying to do what they were asking me to do and get the whole ride, you know. And so the next night I went in, and he gave me – it was a different shaman every night, and he gave me about a half a cup. And I said, the other person gave me a whole cup of this. And he said, yeah, the mother ayahuasca said to give you the night off and tone it down for you. And he, I don't know if he talked to the other guy, and I don't know why he said that. But so I took that dose, and I went outside, and I sat for, and I noticed it had been a while, and it started coming on to me, and I just felt this overpouring of love. I mean, it was just amazing for everything. I felt it just filling my body with just love and happiness. And so that night, I was really just digging on the music, got up and danced. Everybody wears white, and I thought it, I didn't know why at first, but that's so they can't see you. They can see you sneaking off to your room to get some smokes because they busted me doing that the first night. I was like trying to creep away. I'm like, I didn't know you could smoke out here. But that was great. And afterwards, I really felt a just deep connection to the whole place, you know. Felt like this was, you know, a journey that was, you know, designed for me, you know, because I just felt wonderful about myself, about decisions I was making, about the direction I was headed in my life and all this stuff. And then the next night was a bigger dose, and I went back and got a bigger dose and went back and got another dose and just rode it out and fucking loved it. And it was really just that first. And he said that the first night was kind of a death, and the second night was a, kind of a rebirth. And I'm like, okay, whatever. So the last night, you start it at like 7, I think, and it's over at 12:30, that experience. And then the last night, you start at 5, and it goes till 10 o'clock the next day. So you do smaller doses, but you do them all night long. And that was really groovy for me, but this one chick completely wigged out. And I mean, kicking, screaming, yelling, really unpleasant. And they had to take her outside and tie her up before she hurt somebody. God. And I thought, why aren't these guys wigging out over this? Because I am, you know, because it looked like she was going to hurt somebody or hurt herself, and they were having a hard time controlling her. And she didn't even know that it was an ayahuasca place. She thought it was a yoga place, and her husband signed her up for it. Now, she had done ayahuasca 3 other nights and was fine, but this time she just fucking lost it. And so they took her outside, and they just bound her up, and they stayed with her. And but here's the thing. When it's over, it's over. And even though everybody was really concerned about her, she came back in with the biggest smile on her face. And she had some demons, and she needed to work through it, and it was horrible. And I know what it was that happened to her because they told me, and it was awful, awful, awful.
So some and stuff from her past.
Some stuff from her past. Horrible, I wouldn't even say it.
Yeah.
And so she went from who knows what in what place she was in to the biggest smile I've ever seen. And she worked through whatever it was. And and then I met some friends down there. They got married the next morning. We'd been up all night and, you know, some ceremony thing, but I was just into it, you know? And then Jeannie, my girlfriend, came out, and then I was going to stay for 2 weeks, and I decided not to. So I'm going to go back another week and do it again.
When are you going to go back?
I don't know. I haven't decided. My schedule's so packed now, I can't even find a spot for it. And then I'm going to do stand-up for one more year, and then I'm going to retire.
Watch the entire episode for free only on Spotify.
So we're back with Professor Carlson. Professor, could you expound a little from a professional point of view as to Ron White's experience. And I'd like to announce that in further research, as a result of his experience with the ayahuasca, he no longer drinks. Which
That's
is
right.
Fine.
I think he's been,
so,
as of that broadcast,
yes.
I think he reported that he had not had a drink for almost 16 months. And remember, this guy not only was a heavy drinker, but his drinking, kind of like, if those remember the old Dean Martin kind of character he played, his drinking was a part of his stand-up comedy act. It was really embedded in that act. It was almost like part of the character that he played. So that was probably hard for him to shed as well. But what they're talking about, this is there's actually a very interesting documentary about this place, Arrhythmia, which is in Costa Rica, and how it came together, the individuals that created this, how they came together and created this. In fact, Rosie Perez is in the documentary, and there's a number of other pretty famous people that are in the documentary. But as far as the specifics around ayahuasca, as Ron said, it's not necessarily a very pleasant experience. And people that do it, they have to have a preparation. They talked to him about he needed to be off alcohol for a particular period of time. Most of the time, they give people a list of medications that they cannot be taking concurrently if they do the ayahuasca. And so they have to very much consult with their doctors or any therapist that they're working with to make sure that they can make those changes. And also, you have to make some pretty significant dietary changes, like about a couple of weeks before the experience. So your system is kind of cleaned out because, as he said, when you take the medicine, it has some gastrointestinal distress, and so some people throw up, you know, other people get diarrhea. But that is often framed as part of what they call the purge, which is you're kind of releasing in physical form some of the blockages or defenses or even demons out of your system. And once that's released, then you're much, much more open to the experience, which, you know, can include all kinds of, you know, it tends to be a very, very visual experience. But, you know, and Michael Pollan, who is an author, famous author, who's written a lot about food and things like that, wrote a book about how to change your life. And he documented some of the experiences that he had personally with psilocybin and also ayahuasca. And again, it's not something that people go, this is not like something that people do for a vacation or for fun. It's a very serious endeavor, and it's worthy to have consultation and have people learn quite a bit about it ahead of time. But this particular center, this Arrhythmia, was set up in some ways to create a very, very safe setting for people, because ayahuasca has become big business in the Amazon, and there's a lot of charlatans and a lot of people that are not really trained. They call themselves shaman, and people sometimes have negative experiences. So anybody who's actually considering that should go into it with real open eyes and be very cautious about that experience.
An example real quick, and this is short, Dave Chappelle, right? We're always entertaining on our shows, Eric, you know, he's kind of straight up talk about his unsupervised experience with mushrooms. We're going to play that right now, okay?
Okay.
Too much shit out there to stress you out. This whole world is drug-infested, hate-infested, drug-infested world. Hate drugs. I heard the worst drug story. You know what my friend told me? You know what he's dealing with? His landlord is hooked on crack. That's terrible. That's pressure. Your landlord's hooked on crack, that means you gotta have the rent. He come around, I got the rent. It's not even due yet, it's the 10th. Come on, I need it. Let me just get $20 of it now, and then give me the rest of the end of the month. Every couple hours, hey, look, I'm gonna need some more of the rent. Building's falling apart, things came up. Comes home early from a party. Landlord's in the crib going through his shit. What are you doing in my house? Ah! Where's the sink? I came to fix it.
What's in the kitchen? I thought it was in the drawer. I'll fix it tomorrow when I come for the rent. You know what I hate about drugs? I hate when, like, people my age and older get hooked on crack. I hate that shit. You're too old to be experimenting with the drugs at a certain point. You should be past that. You ain't doing it by a certain point. You just miss it. Drugs are really for old people anyway. You 75, you've earned the right. Shit, if I was 75, I'd do coke, heroin, everything. I wouldn't give a fuck. I'd be walking down the street. They'd be like, boy, that old man is tripping. Can't do everything. Maybe weed. If you're going to do something, do a little weed. Smoke some weed. Weed's not as bad as everything else. Weed is a background substance. You know what I mean? You can smoke some herb and still function. And you ain't crisp, but you'll function. Nothing higher than weed, though. I made that mistake one time. I was at a party. Some guy gave me some shit. He's like, here, man, take this. It's fucking mushrooms. I took it. I forgot all about it, you know. Then a couple days later, I found that shit in my pocket. I'm thinking, why not? Because I'm thinking it's like weed, some background shit. I planned my whole day out like it was weed. I'll chew this shit up. Then I'll go to the barbershop, get my hair cut, and then I'll see a movie. Shoot it up. So far, so good. Then I was in a barber shop, like an hour later. And it's funny because I was just thinking to myself, I was like, ooh, this stuff sucks. Tastes like athlete's foot. I feel sick, but I'm not really high. Then I looked in the mirror. I saw the barber's reflection, man. It looked like a big penis was cutting my hair. I freaked out. I started talking to myself, Dave, calm down. You're on drugs. This is what drugs do. Okay, you know that there was no way that a penis can cut hair. But I started freaking out, man. I just couldn't take it anymore. I jumped out the chair. Half my hair was cut. I didn't care. I just gave a barber a handful of money. It was weird. The balls opened up. Anyway, I ran home, man. I ran home as fast as I could. Tripping. I looked at the clock. It was 2:42. I was like, damn, 2:42. I got to sober up. I've never been this high this early. I took a shower. I was still high. Said maybe music will do the trick. I listened to every CD I had. I was still high. Exercise. That's what I'll do. I ran around the block 4 times. Still high. Took a nap. Woke up. Fucked up. I looked at the clock. It was 2:43. I said, God damn.
And there's an example, Eric, of you have to have respect for plant medicines. All plants, even weeds, are herbs in medicine. And we can't do it. That was funny, but we can't do it unsupervised. And could you kind of touch on that a little more, Eric?
Sure, because, you know, when you're in one of the two things that are attributed to Dr. Timothy Leary that I think are major contributions about approaching any kind of plant medicine that has psychedelic qualities, are the two terms are set and setting. and the set refers to the mindset that somebody comes into the experience with. And the setting is obviously where somebody is and whether it's safe and it's familiar. So, you know, the mindset is very, very important. You know, you don't go into taking any of these plant medicines right after a breakup or after you lost your job or some extreme trauma. You want to put yourself into a mindset. You don't have to be perfect, but you want to put yourself into kind of a growth mindset where you have set certain intentions about what you're looking for from the experience. And then the second part is the setting. You know, hopefully you're in a setting that's familiar to you, or you're with people that you trust and care about you, people that are not necessarily doing the plant medicine but are there to kind of watch over you. Sometimes we call that a sitter. And, you know, there's a lot of experiences people have sometimes where they go to settings like concerts and take way too many mushrooms or something like that, and they have a very, very negative experience because maybe they get separated from their friends, or it just kind of takes a turn in a negative direction. And I've counseled people that have had those kinds of experiences. So if a person does make the choice, and again, I want to make clear, I'm not advocating for these for people to make these choices, but if they've done their research and they've decided they think there might be some benefit to doing this, then it's really important for them to have a setting and to, you know, establish a positive mindset going into the experience. Now, one of the things that, you know, it's funny, the Dave Chappelle clip where he goes, oh, it's 2:42, and he saw himself doing all these things and only a minute has elapsed. It does can distort one sense of time, but not that different than ayahuasca. The experience is over with, the peak experience is over with in about 2 hours. It doesn't mean that there aren't some lingering effects, but it's not a long-term experience, and nor is the MDMA, and that's why those two things are being studied to treat trauma, because it's a short enough period of time that the person can come down and kind of, for lack of a better word, sober up, and then they can basically function normally after that and process the experience. Longer acting substances like ibogaine or LSD, there's a little bit more of a limitation in using them therapeutically because the effects can last like 2 or 3 times as long as psilocybin or as ayahuasca. Although there is, you know, there are some research studies being conducted at this point on those particular things. But I guess the other thing I want to say is that sometimes the fear of these substances are based on misinformation and a lack of understanding of the research, and maybe based on old mythologies that were told back in the 60s, where they said things like, oh, you know, LSD causes chromosome damage. Well, that has been debunked over 35 years ago, but those misguided understandings still persist today, and that's unfortunate. So there needs to be a whole lot of education around the risks, but also the potential benefits, and that information and that research is really pretty, pretty strong. Oregon, as of 2023, Oregon had on the ballot in the 2020 election a proposal which people voted for the legal use of psilocybin, not recreationally, but in controlled wellness centers, and they did pass that. And so it'll now be in 2023, they'll start to have applications of opening these centers. But there's been many parts of Oregon, the state of Oregon, mainly in the rural areas, that are very resistant to this and have a lot of fears about that. Now, that's understandable. But, you know, the fears that they have are probably not really based on, you know, the reality of the risk. In controlled settings, those things can be very, very safe experiences. You know, we talk about bad trips. Sometimes people will talk about this. Sometimes the experiences, as Ron White was outlining, can be very, very challenging. And even with that one individual, that female he was citing that he observed, can be very, very challenging. But with the right kind of help and support in making the environment safe and secure, that even that individual who had seemingly was having a bad trip came out of it. and exorcised a lot of demons. I mean, you yourself know so well the impact of child abuse and trauma. These are demons that we can all carry with us, and some of these medicines are very, very powerful, and they can bring those things out. So people need to be educated and be prepared that there is potential there, and that they're working, you know, with a program or a medically supervised program that can anticipate that and knows exactly how to respond to that therapeutically.
And I'd just like to do a verbal commercial, Eric, before we get to the closing words. If you'd like to be a guest on Alternatives for a Healthier Lifestyle, just shoot us an email at BOP, Freedom Radio, at yahoo.com. And, of course, we're every other week, every other Friday. So the second Friday and the fourth Friday of every month until we expand a little. And the second commercial on Amazon, I ask all the listeners, all right, because this is an important campaign. Go to Amazon and type in Slave in Modern America - From the Eyes of a Child, series on child abuse and child sex slavery. It's true stories in a campaign with FreeChildProject.com to urge the United States to ratify the Declaration of the Rights of the Child. If you purchase the book rather than Kindle, a dollar from each sale goes to Operation Underground Railroad, which is a group of ex-military and other individuals who actually perform raids on places across the country, including the U.S., across the world, to free children that are enslaved to sex or females that are enslaved to sex, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and also to NASCA.org, NAASCA.org, which is the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. So please purchase my book and join in support of all children. Now, there's a link on our program page. You'll see it on the bottom, Slave in Modern America. Just tap that. It'll take you right to the book. There's also a link to Ayahuasca, which will take you to Wikipedia that breaks down the known details regarding that special plant medicine. And the foreword in the book was written by our very own Professor Eric Carlson, who aided in the development of the project. And it's edited by Lisa Petroselli. Now, help us establish rights for the child. Order your copy today, Slave in Modern America - From the Eyes of a Child. Now, Professor Carlson, I'd like to do a few minutes of a closing words regarding the necessity to be more open to groups, excuse me, and to pioneering of very important plant therapy. I give you the floor.
Well, you know, there can be a lot of barriers to people seeking out help, but and this time, you know, I have a profile that I list my therapeutic services on Psychology Today, and I get inundated with emails and calls, and, you know, I try to fit in as many people as I can work with, but that's why I've, you know, kind of started to focus my work on doing group therapies, because you can work with people, work with more people at the same time. Not everybody needs individual one-on-one therapy on a weekly basis, so I try to focus in on the groups. And I guess my message would be to, you know, if you're struggling with something, don't let it come to such a crisis that it's almost impossible to reach out for help. Like Steve was discussing with his friend that he, like, went on a vacation and decided to quit his job. You don't have to create a crisis in your life to reach out for help. I think that our mental health should be viewed in the same way as our physical health. You go to the doctor, you have your blood pressure taken, you get your annual physical, you have blood work done. And in some ways we need to, you know, be on the guard to check on our mental health and not be afraid to reach out for help. So, you know, if anybody is interested, they can go out to my profile on Psychology Today, send me an email, or send me an email to brainwisesolutions@gmail.com. And if I don't have the space to work with them, I will certainly let them know what different resources are available in their community. But, you know, to me, the bottom line message is that it actually takes a lot more courage to admit that we need the assistance of others than pretending that we have it all together. I've been doing men's groups for many, many years, and sometimes what would happen in men's group is people participate in the group for a period of time, and all of a sudden we wouldn't see them for a couple of weeks, and people would even call them, and they wouldn't get back to us, and then they might show up like a month later, and they would tell us their story, like, oh, I went through this, and I went through that, and I went through this, but I landed on my feet. It's like they kind of went through their crisis alone, and then they reported this sort of heroic journey. And we try to encourage people, listen, you didn't have to deal with that on your own. You could have picked up the phone. You could have come to group. But oftentimes the underlying issue that prevents people from reaching out at their time of greatest need is shame. They just feel embarrassed and ashamed that they're struggling with things. And the group helps dissipate the shame because everybody in that group can relate to that struggle. And when everybody relates to it, that means that they can be open and honest, authentic, as Steve was referring to, and also be supporting one another without judgment. And that's probably the cornerstone of the group, is supporting people without judgment. And that doesn't mean that people don't give other people feedback or ideas about how they should handle something, but they don't judge people's mistakes. They encourage, because if you do, then people will just shut down. So those are, I think, some final thoughts. And I really appreciate all the work that you have done highlighting these issues of abuse, and that your project has finally come to fruition. I'm so excited for you, and I can't wait to receive my copy of the book.
Yes. Thanks for reminding me. But I easily, while Eric was talking, I went to Google, I typed in Eric Carlson, CARLSON, space, Psychology Today, and his page came right up. So anybody can do that. That's a way to contact them. And, of course, always watch for our show and the posting on Facebook for our show, Alternatives for a Healthier Lifestyle. I'd like to thank you very much for co-hosting today and being with us, Professor Carlson, and you're a good friend of mine, and I love working with you.
Yeah, the same for me. So I appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for the work that you're doing. It really is benefiting people.
Great. And a song that we can all relate to is a local group, my friend Bobby Nazzo, and Malcolm Lovegrove, and produced by DJ J Green, D-Lo Beats. To all my friends, peace, love, and revolution. We got more coming at you. Skip a week, and we'll be there.
For you, many times. carry you when I can.
Friends, I cry with you.
We-